This is a conversation I had with Jeffrey Ong, a PhD candidate at Columbia University, on colonialism, capitalism, and Myanmar. I should note this conversation happened before the COVID-19 global pandemic. Our conversation is a casual one on serious issues. We discuss how capitalism and capitalist desires are changing Myanmar, what revolutionary tendencies and ideologies remain in the country, and how imperial desires in the form of tourism and tourists still shape the tastes of visitors to Myanmar. Why do we still find glamour in the colonial structures that exist in the country, rather than view them as tragic monuments of violent tendencies in countries like Britain or the US? Jeff was also kind enough to send us a brief PS on communism and anarchism in Myanmar today. That will be attached at the end of our interview for those who are interested. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog on Apple or Spotify by searching for the Arts of Travel podcast. We have fascinating conversations with guests on India, Lebanon, China, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, and many other locations around the world. You can also go to our website, asiaarttours.com, for print interviews on a variety of subjects. All right, here's my conversation now with Jeffrey Ong on Myanmar. I hope you enjoy our chat today. How do you see within the tourism of Myanmar, how are we recreating colonialism? Do you think this is something we need to be very conscious of? And is it something that's even perpetuated by those in the tourism industry of Myanmar, of trying to make sure that it remains exotic in the eyes of the Western customer who has a lucrative budget to spend on these sort of colonial fantasies?
So I'm glad you raised it. I'm not sure that I have very sort of fully formed or articulate thoughts on this. I mean, there have been some critical kind of projects and programs that try to maybe kind of promote, you know, of course, like a more sort of careful or critical kind of tourism that might depart from some of the sort of worst practices that you mentioned. But in terms of tourism's relationship to colonialism, I guess my main thought is that I, broadly speaking, I agree. It seems to me that the debate around the place of tourism in Burma, maybe especially since 2010, would have to be brought into relationship with the debate about kind of investment more broadly, kind of foreign capital investment, neoliberalization, economic reforms. And the way that debate happens is not always, it's not always so easy, I guess I want to say. On one hand, you have people who are arguing in a very sort of direct way that after kind of decades of political and economic deprivation, having more foreign investment is simply good. There's that argument, but there's also the argument that people want it. So I mean that comes up with stuff around, right? Like you might have seen that KFC and Krispy Kreme are going to be moving into the Secretariat in downtown Yangon, one of the sort of most important buildings that people think of in kind of heritage terms in downtown Yangon. I think the response to that has to be part of a broader kind of critique of capitalist political economy. So whether that's kind of tourism, whether that's KFC. Ideally, one formulates a, one has a sort of concern that that's also kind of routed through what people in the country actually believe and want, which is where I think things can maybe get a little bit more complicated. I mean, around Douai, for example, when people talk about special economic zones, a lot of, I think, generally very good kind of activist and civil society work in the region moves very quickly to condemn special economic zones, and rightly so, I mean, for sure. I worry sometimes that there's a tendency to sort of pass over some of the kind of difficult questions that you could frame in maybe basic organizing terms, in terms of, special economic zones are these sort of heinous exploitative projects for sure. So what do you actually do when people in one of those areas wants a project like that? Which is not necessarily the case in and around Douai. I mean, it would be hard to conduct a sort of, I don't know, a sort of properly quantitative study in those terms. But there are a number of people who say that who sort of believe in what they believe in what they see as the promise of industrial development in a place they understand themselves to be sort of far too long, kind of peripheral from political and economic development. So I think things can get a little bit more difficult in those terms. I'm not sure there are sort of easy answers there, actually. But I think for kind of people who want to be developing a kind of politics around raising questions about things like foreign direct investment, maybe tourism as a kind of subset of that, even though I would imagine probably not all tourism falls under foreign direct investment, of course. But how do you develop how might one develop a kind of radical or in some sense leftist response to this that actually engages with the aspirations of people who see something in those things? And if people do see something in those things, how do you respond to that? I'm not always entirely sure. Around Douai, for example, the demand often is not, in fact, to suspend or cancel the special economic zone project. In fact, it's been suspended since 2013. The demand from a lot of people living in the villages in the project area is for things like more financial compensation, greater access to public infrastructures, more job opportunities. And for them, their understanding is that restarting the project is the only thing that will bring those things. So that raises pretty difficult political questions for people who have quite reasonable concerns about the SEZ project. So I don't know. It's tough to say sometimes. But I feel like I might have lost track of your original question.
I think the question is sort of when you look at something like UNESCO and they go around getting certification for monuments to colonialism, and then you see a bunch of white people who are the descendants of those colonialists going to these sites, do we need to at some point start saying you're worshiping colonialism? And people will, you know, it's very creepy when you go to these sites, be it a French colonial building in Battambang or, you know, an Anglican church in Burma, and you see all these white people and they say, oh, the architecture is so beautiful. Oh, you know, wow, this, they really knew how to make things back then. And, you know, not to be too Marxist about it, but for, you know, there's a lot of dead labor. If we want to make sort of a pun out of it, a lot of people died to make these structures under conditions that would be more closely related to slavery than it would sort of the capitalist wage labor paradigm we have now. So I just am very torn about how tourism does not interrogate these structures, and instead it sort of reifies them.
And I'm not entirely alone in this, but I have been quite kind of skeptical of much of the kind of heritage work that's been happening in downtown Yangon. I guess I want to balance that with saying that I think there are some people, for example, working within Yangon Heritage Trust, who I think are sort of good and genuine characters who are for sure like people who were born and raised in Yangon who kind of want to do the right thing in terms of having a kind of historical record in place through which one can actually at least open up a conversation about colonialism and what it meant to different people, including its sort of ravages throughout the country. On the other hand, yeah, I mean, for sure, I think that the sort of complicity with the colonial legacy often goes unexamined. I think there's no doubt about that. And a lot of people who are living in, you know, most of these buildings that people think of as quote heritage buildings are hardly unoccupied. The kind of the infrastructure in a lot of these buildings is not super good. So in many cases, actually, people would like to maybe stay there and not get kicked out, but have better kind of material living conditions, which might mean a building that doesn't resemble like a late 19th century crumbling kind of moss and mold infested building, right? So like the buildings that a lot of foreigners in Yangon see as these sort of like ugly monstrosities, as far as I'm aware, from people who are actually doing this sort of thing, what I understand is that, you know, most people actually prefer to live in those kinds of buildings, which is also quite reasonable in its own way. Not to mention the whole question of kind of dispossession and displacement that happens around the sort of freezing of these buildings in time, right, where they have to be made into these kinds of museums. So I think these things are, it does seem to me that these questions are not often examined. I should caveat that by saying it's not my sort of direct area of work. It's possible that there's more discussion around this that I'm aware of, but from friends of mine who are sort of engaged in these issues, I think these are the kinds of things that could be talked about quite a bit more for sure.
Within the popular Myanmar imagination, and this would be just, what is it, hidden texts of dissent, sort of the grumblings that you hear in the tea houses of Yangon. When you pass by a colonial building, and then you pass by a giant tower brought to you by the Bank of China, is the average Burmese citizen, do they consider themselves going under a new phase of imperialism, or do they on their own, without it being brought up by you, make links from their colonial past under the British to this new era of globalized investment predominantly coming from Chinese capital in their country? Do they see links between this old imperialism and the new?
The most honest answer is that I don't know, because I haven't really talked to people about this. I would say that I would expect the answer to be different for different kinds of people in Burma. So I think at the level of, in particular, sort of class, ethnicity, you might expect more kind of elite people in society to kind of be a little bit more supportive of some of these kinds of foreign investment projects, given that they're more likely to benefit from them. My uncle, for example, I have family living in Yankin and Yangon, and my uncle there has been living in a building that there's been a lot of discussion about raising it, rebuilding something else in its place, relocating him and his family, our family, somewhere else. I mean, my understanding, like a lot of people who are living in buildings that are kind of not in great shape, his preference would be to stay there, but in a nicer, in better conditions. And that is maybe difficult to expect, right? Because when you build something new in its place, I mean, typically what happens is that people don't get to stay there, right? It's more expensive. And that's how you end up with poorer people being pushed out in various directions. In certain parts of Yangon, I think this kind of issue is starting to come to the fore. I mean, there are definitely forms of political mobilization related to housing displacement that maybe raise some of these questions of kind of core and periphery within the city, and sort of who benefits from these sort of new forms of investment. It seems to me maybe they're still at a relatively kind of nascent stage. And you also have, these kinds of cycles of investment, right? So like after 2010, maybe for 5 or 6 years, again, it's not something that I follow super closely, but for a while, of course, I mean, housing prices were skyrocketing. And supposedly they've cooled off quite a bit at this point, which might be good for people who don't have as much money to spend on that sort of thing. But maybe that will change again soon. I mean, these kind of boom bust cycles with kind of speculative capital, I mean, I would assume that will become more the norm than the exception as more finance capital kind of cycles into the country.
Mm-hmm. And so Myanmar is very interesting in that the enclosing of the commons is not completed. You have all these autonomous zones still, or areas that are very much up for debate in terms of sovereignty. I'm thinking particularly of Kachin State. You could apply that probably to territories that the Rohingya occupy, and we'll talk about them shortly. But I'm wondering if we had to look at the competing languages of desire. A fellow PhD of yours who you might bump into, Claudio Soprinzetti, has done really good work in Thailand, articulating or trying to articulate to leftists, like, look, you can fucking talk about Marx all you want. People want iPhones. So until you either figure out how to use the iPhone as a symbol of Marxism or come up with something better than an iPhone, you're shit out of luck. No one's trading Das Kapital for an iPhone. But for these people who aren't willing, and per my understanding in general, very crassly, of how the state attempts to sort of perpetuate neoliberal capitalism, is it makes that bargain of it essentially says, we'll give you an iPhone in terms of sort of the you can get a house, you can, creating the image of the capitalist version of the citizens, creating a capitalist dream world, creating a capitalist possibility of what Myanmar can become. So I'm wondering for the people who are fighting in places like Kachin State or the other autonomous areas, why are they not willing to give up for this sort of capitalist dream world that the Myanmar state is creating for its citizens in places like in a Yangon? What is the other sort of dreams that people in autonomous zones want? And in general, does this bargain describe really what is motivating a lot of Myanmar's citizens in the area's capital controls? They just want an iPhone, they just want to get an apartment, and that is going to be their legacy.
I mean, I think in a lot of kind of ethnic nationality areas, places like Kachin State, I mean, the concern, of course, and one reason that in one form or another conflicts have continued is because people understand, rightly, I think, in those areas that there's a concern about who will control and extract resources from those areas in the context of a sort of long-term peace agreement. So I guess put differently, the kind of capitalist dream world that you suggest, I mean, I think people understand that it's they're not the ones who are going to benefit from that. Other people might. And so that's sort of part of what animates, I think, some of these conflicts. But I do think that, you know, to the point about whether or not sort of Marxists or leftists should or could sort of come up with something better than an iPhone. I mean, you know, I guess it seems to me that maybe misunderstands some of the historical dynamics at work. And I mean, not to get like too abstract, I guess it doesn't need to be abstract though, but you know, I mean, there's the whole argument that we're sort of hurtling towards a kind of ecological collapse, right? An ecological collapse that will not and is not being experienced the same by all people, for sure. But I think if there are sort of conditions that might lead to revolutionary prospects in one form or another, I don't think that it comes from a sort of like moving beyond the sort of consumerism of the present, but rather the collapse of our current material conditions. I mean, I think if there's anything that would lead to a sort of uprising or rebellious kind of situation, and you're seeing it in various parts of the world already, I mean, it's kind of deindustrialization and ecological collapse. So I don't think that leftists need a better iPhone in order to sort of look towards another world. I mean, I think the political unconscious or this sort of the implications of a lot of what we see already tells us that, you know, another kind of world is going to be coming whether we want it to or not. And it's a question of sort of shaping that process, I think.
I think the iPhone is a very seductive package that encapsulates a lot of how we've been trained to desire it. I guess I'm wondering for those in a place like Kachin State, sort of what are they fighting for what you've suggested, maybe it's not what we desire, but it's what we need to do to survive. Are we starting to see that in areas of Myanmar where the commons have been enclosed, but the resources or extraction abilities of the state to produce wealth from resource use have failed? Are we starting to see either these articulations in places like Kachin, where they figured out a way, it might be very unique because of the spiritual and ethnic considerations of Kachin State, but what would be sort of their vision of desire, and what would be examples within Myanmar of this sort of, no, it's not desire, it's just that this is what we literally need to do to survive. We can't survive under the model of neoliberal capitalism the Myanmar state is trying to introduce. We need to have this other vision. Could you elaborate on either of those poles as you're knowledgeable about them?
Yeah, I think you hit on. I think this question of desire, I do think that's like hugely important. And much of my work in the South around Dawe is sort of about this kind of aspirational kind of thing that's going on, where people actually identify with what they believe something like this SEZ project will bring. I think it really depends on people's relationship to state and capital, maybe to put it in like slightly too simplistic terms. I think in vast portions of Kachin State, people quite rightly don't see themselves in the sort of image of what capital offers. I mean, let me put that differently, actually. I think plenty of people in Kachin State who've been fighting with and alongside, let's say, the KIA, the KIO, Kachin Independence Association, and or organization for quite a long period of time, would probably be very happy to have an iPhone. And I'm sure there are a number of iPhones circulating in kind of liberated areas of Kachin State. But I think where the sort of question of kind of peace and conflict, where it really starts to hit something is actually around some of the kind of resource politics. So I think a lot of people in Kachin State would be happy to have sort of greater consumer opportunities. But they rightly understand that maybe more autonomous control of the areas where they come from might be better for them in the long term. So I think they would probably hope for not sort of either or, but both and, in terms of sort of consumerism and a kind of resource sovereignty, if that makes sense.
If we had to boil down into slogans, so Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, what are some of the revolutionary slogans, if any, that we would associate with contemporary Myanmar? And would these have historic links to movements of communism or anarchism within Myanmar?
A couple that come to mind. I mean, one would be Land in Our Hands, which, I mean, is more the name of a network. But it has a kind of, I would say, a sort of propagandistic power in a good way. another would be We Will Manage Our Own Resources, which is a kind of phrase, but maybe also like in a certain sense, a rallying cry that has emerged powerfully from certain Karen areas in the Southeast in particular. But I don't know what kind of relation they might bear to longer leftist genealogies. I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, I mean, I think there was the existence of the BAKAPA, the Burmese Communist Party, for many decades. How to say? I mean, well, the collapse of the Burmese Communist Party in the late 80s, I think, maybe sort of brought to close a certain kind of historical cycle, if I could put it that way, such that the kind of political imagination we see these days might not have a kind of direct connection to some of these kind of older struggles, which is not to say that obviously the long-running communist insurgency in Burma, which was very long, and certainly had and it was disastrous at certain points as well. I mean, it must be said, but definitely had a kind of land politics. I mean, there was this whole shift. There was this whole debate in the late 40s between two different lines. One line would be a strategy centered on worker organizing in the cities through sort of general strikes and isolating the government in that way, or a kind of Maoist line based on peasant insurgency and encircling the cities. And it went in the latter direction. And through the strength of the communist insurgency, I mean, the communists controlled large portions of the countryside of Upper Burma. And so you could argue that it was in many ways a sort of land-oriented political struggle. I mean, you could go back to the anti-colonial revolution as well, where there's this amazing figure, I don't know if it would ring a bell or not, but this guy who went by Thikin Bolaji, who was a labor leader in the oil fields of Yeinanjiang in Upper Burma. And there was a sort of massive strike in the oil fields. There was a march on Yangon. This sort of anchored the left wing of the anti-colonial struggle, where you had sort of student leaders who were otherwise from more or less sort of kind of middle class backgrounds, from sort of national schools rather than the sort of truly sort of upper class kind of colonial schools. They sort of joined this march. It was this moment of coming together between sort of different strands of the anti-colonial struggle. So you could say that a politics around sort of land, resources, labor, and radical political action, militant political action, sort of anchored this aspect of the anti-colonial struggle. These days, I mean, I think that kind of story doesn't get told so often. As I said, I think the collapse of a kind of formal communist project in Burma by the late 80s is a big part of that. I think another big part of that is the fact that the ruling party for quite a few decades was formerly socialist, Not just formally, actually. I would say they were kind of actually socialist. If by socialist we understand a project that is not necessarily emancipatory, in many places, including in Burma for a number of decades. But I think there's a tendency for people to say, to react to any discussion of sort of left or leftism with a kind of, oh, no, we tried that and it didn't work, right? And this is hardly a sort of unique story in Burma. This is a story that happened in different ways across much of Asia, certainly. And is part of a kind of maybe apolitical present in certain ways, at least in Burma, where the kind of more radical strands of kind of activist work tends not to draw on any kind of sort of explicit leftist language. I mean, there is some of this, but it tends more towards a sort of liberal imagination around sort of human rights and democracy on one hand, maybe principles like transparency and accountability. And I, in my work and in spending time in Burma and trying to support, as much as I can, at least kind of activist networks, I try to be respectful to that kind of political imagination while also trying to, maybe sort of constructively suggest some of the limits to that and kind of talk with people to think about maybe other ways of thinking about these issues. But it's not always easy, of course. But
how do we, for something like the Rohingya or you know, women's rights, does that exist organically within Myanmar itself? Is that something that is brought into being by those in Myanmar, or is that the West, even if it's well-intentioned, again, speaking over and for the people there? So I guess, did people in Myanmar think Aung San Suu Kyi had, yes, queen energy? Was that entirely from the West? And for these conversations about the Rohingya, again, are we narrating over the people in Myanmar rather than trying to listen and figure out why these issues are happening and what the Myanmar people want to do about them?
I do think that Aung San Suu Kyi has, I mean, she has tremendous genuine support in the country. I think it would be hard to overstate her kind of level of kind of moral and intellectual leadership, to use maybe an outdated Gramscian phrase. I mean, I think she did have that kind of yes queen energy, I suppose, among exiles as well. I mean, which is sort of my own kind of like my own sort of home community, I suppose. Although that's fallen away a lot in recent years. But I guess for me the issue is maybe not whether people were, I guess, okay, let me put it this way. I don't think that she's a fraud, in the sense that I don't think she's abandoned her liberal principles, which I do think she holds. I just think that, as the history of liberalism teaches us over and over again, you can be a liberal and be completely at peace with settler colonialism and primitive accumulation in extremely violent ways. I mean, this is the history of slavery. This is the history of settler colonialism from Australia to Israel to the US to South Africa. I mean, these are liberal histories. So I don't think that she has abandoned liberalism. I think in many ways she's a perfect liberal. In many ways she's learned all the right arguments from the West. I mean, those are wrong arguments in certain ways, but she has learned, for example, that in the post 9/11 war world, human rights is something that can be waged very effectively against Islam, for example. I think she's sort of perfectly compatible with the sort of Bush doctrine foreign policy, which has a certain moral framework. And for people who don't fit that, they then become objects of a kind of necessary violence. For me, that's the sort of basics, maybe, of what we've seen in recent years. What's interesting to me is that people understand this as a kind of betrayal of liberal principles among kind of Western commentators, which suggests to me the sort of ongoing and sort of shocking inability of sort of the sort of liberal intelligentsia of the West in terms of being able to come to sort of any understanding with the history of liberalism as an extraordinarily violent project over centuries. That's sort of where I would come in on some of those issues. In terms of the kind of imagination of people in Burma with respect to Rohingya issues. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's I'm not sure how much I can really say, except that I think, like a lot of people, I suppose I've been, of course, very, very sort of, I've found it difficult to sort of witness a lot of what we've seen over recent years. But I guess the difference I'm trying to make maybe is that I don't think that what we've seen, not only from Aung San Suu Kyi, but in this sort of public sphere in Burma by sort of treasured democratic figures, people like Minh Khon Aung and others, is actually unfortunately a kind of fidelity to a certain kind of liberal project. And so to me, what's disappointing is not that they might have sort of retreated from principles they did or did not hold in the past, but actually understanding them as part of this sort of broader history.
What are the most pertinent questions for Myanmar's future as you think it connects to this greater project of global governance? If we're sort of seeing the death of liberalism, its contradictions revealed as a growing precariat and immigrant class globally is left to die or is made into an expendable population that is liquidated. I wish I could say it more subtly, but I can't think of how. How should we see the current events in Myanmar through, and I'm sorry to get all NPR on you, but through like the events of what's happening within Europe's borders, what is happening in Australia, what's happening under Trump. How do the what's happened to the Rohingya reflect on, as you said, sort of the fidelity of liberalism, and does it point to or offer you maybe a dark vision of things to come, or is there something else there that I'm missing?
It is a kind of dark history of things to come, I suppose. I mean, in like super blatant terms, and I've talked about this with some of the guys at Chung and written about this a bit on their blog. But I think in many ways, what we see in Rakhine State with the expulsion of vast Rohingya communities is something like a sort of violent logic of how to manage surplus populations, where it might be easier to kill off a lot of people who are sort of no longer useful to formal capitalist production. I mean, this is the sort of abjection of surplus populations writ large. And I do think it's something that you see from the Mediterranean to the camps in Bangladesh along the border with Rakhine State. It is a dark picture. I'm not sure. I mean, what various people from sort of maybe Marx to Polanyi try to teach us is that in these kind of dark times, you have this sort of dialectical sort of maybe, you know, something else emerges where people, you know, try and create something better, right? It sort of inspires maybe revolutionary upheaval. It's actually not clear to me what people should do, because I'm not really sure. You know, I was just listening to what I thought was a pretty good discussion between, do you know this guy, Joshua Clover?
Yeah, his mama is Carol Clover, who wrote one of the best horror textbooks from a feminist lens. And he wrote Riot Strike Riot.
Right. So he just did a podcast with this guy, Bernard Harcourt from Columbia, about the relationship between theory and praxis. And I think I agree with Clover when he said that he's not actually sure that the kinds of theorizing that tends to happen in sort of, at least like in kind of academic, but also to some extent, to a great extent, in kind of radical circles as well, whether or not that informs or creates very much praxis. For him, praxis is maybe in some ways a bit more autonomous, and it will only ever emerge from sort of organic historical conditions. So there's maybe not very much that someone like me could do, for example, and at the level of sort of clarifying what's going on, or like I was saying before, and I got some of what I said before from Clover as well. This whole question of the sort of long history of ideology critique in the 20th century, and maybe whether or not that might be coming to a close. I mean, I think the one of the lessons we take from that story is that it didn't really work. And maybe now that we see these sort of the sort of gears starting to come into crisis, to mix metaphors, sorry about that. But the contradictions of liberalism may be emerging with more clarity since 2008, and we see different kinds of struggles emerging. That will happen, I think, no matter what someone like me writes on a blog with Chuang, for better or for worse. So I don't know. I think forms of struggle do tend to reflect their sort of material underlying conditions. Although I do think forms of struggle also can themselves then also transform material conditions. So it's not like entirely a sort of base superstructure kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, if and when we're likely to see something that might, in a sort of coherent way, push back on the kind of abjection of surplus populations. Yeah, I mean, I think we do see that to a certain extent in when we think about the sort of riots of London or the banlieue outside Paris. You could argue that the movement of the squares was maybe in certain places contained some of this kind of impulse as well. But the question is whether or not these might sort of concatenate into something larger, and what kinds of work might be necessary to make that happen. And those, I think, kind of remain open questions, I suppose.
This is a brief PS that Jeff was kind enough to send me on communism and anarchism on the ground in Myanmar today. Please note the audio is a bit rough, as this is a voice recording, but it was so interesting, I wanted to include it as a PS. Thank you.
To the first follow-up question about how anti-colonial protests or rebellions led to the formation of the anarchists and communists in Burma. Well, there's definitely a strong relationship between the anti-colonial struggle and the eventual communist insurgency. The Communist Party was founded just before World War II sort of properly broke out. A lot of the kind of key nationalist leaders were formally involved in founding the Communist Party of Burma, including Aung San. However, the party sort of falls away in the chaos of the first couple years of the war. And then a sort of new and slightly different generation of leaders takes firmer control. You had people like Thikin Than Thun, Thikin So, Goshal. These were sort of the three key figures. Thikin So, so a split emerges in the Communist Party as the war continues. Thikin So accuses kind of the other guys of taking the kind of Browderist peaceful transition line where a kind of socialist transition would take place through formal political struggle within recognized political apparatuses. So Thekinso breaks and forms sort of his branch of the communist struggle. He goes underground. And then Thekinso and Ghoshal, eventually they, not very long after that, actually, as far as I understand, they also abandon the peaceful transition line within that kind of main branch of the Communist Party. And they take up armed struggle, and I believe it was March 1946, so before independence, actually. And with late 40s, early 50s, I mean, they're controlling large portions of Upper Burma. And I should say, even during the anti-fascist resistance after the Japanese took over in the Second World War, people identifying as communists, let's say, were critical to pushing out the Japanese at that point already. So, I mean, all of the key leaders of the communist insurgency from those kind of early decades, 40s and 50s, they had their roots in varying degrees in the anti-colonial struggle, in the freedom struggle, for sure. But, you know, the career of the communist insurgency was tragic in many ways. By the 50s, I mean, they end up sort of returning for peace talks, and then the 60s, they're kind of trying a different strategy again. A group of people returns from Beijing in the 1960s, and they initiate a series of quite bloody mass trials and purges in the Bago Yoma, which is a mountainous area where they had their headquarters at that point. Thanton and Ghoshal, who were themselves among and probably the most important figures in the Communist Party at that point, they were both executed in those trials. So there's this attempt to sort of renovate the insurgency along kind of properly Maoist lines, with people who had been in Beijing for a while, who had been kind of like emissaries to Beijing. And at that point, their strategy shifts to claiming and securing base areas in the north and northeast. And they would stay at that point, it's my understanding is they would stay relatively remote from central Burma from that point onwards until they collapse in the late 1980s. As for any kind of anarchist formations, I mean, you know, obviously, James Scott has a whole argument about the kind of, in a sense, the implicit anarchism of a lot of Highland people in Burma. But I guess you could relate that to the various armed rebellions that break out in the Highland areas. Among, let's say, in Kachin areas, Shan areas, Karen areas, Mon, Chin, Kareni, these have maybe a slightly less certain relation to, or let's say maybe a different relation to the earlier anti-colonial struggle. Part of the structure, if we can put it that way, of British colonialism was, of course, to differentiate between so-called Burma proper and kind of lowland Burman Buddhist lowlands and the kind of highland frontier areas. There were different mechanisms of government. There was, of course, a lot of missionary work in the highlands. A lot of ethnic nationality people were incorporated into the British colonial administration, into the army. So the kind of the way that the rebellions take shape in the post-war period, in the post-colonial period, replays in some ways some of the tensions that you could argue gained a certain kind of fuller form under the colonial period. So it's a little bit less straightforward. As far as I'm aware, I don't think any of the ethnic insurgencies claim themselves any sort of explicit anarchism. There are some kind of anarchist tendencies these days. Some kind of young people in Yangon, some quite interesting kind of small scale projects around kind of mutual aid, food distribution. Some kind of like punk rock kind of scenes that definitely are sort of flying the anarchist banner, so to speak. In terms of like a sort of longer history of anarchism, I think that remains more of a kind of, let's say, like a kind of analytic claim on the part of James Scott rather than something that people claim for themselves for the most part. The second question, in terms of how the rhetoric shifted when Burma's military took power, I mean, the thing is, you know, there's a tendency to think of the Bundung Conference and the non-aligned movement that emerged afterwards in very romantic terms, and I understand why, and I'm pretty into Bundung and non-alignment myself. But it's worth remembering that for some, and at certain points, yes, kind of Bandung and non-alignment, these were kind of anti-imperial projects. But they were not always anti-capitalist projects. So, I mean, you could argue that when the Revolutionary Council, when the military takes power in 62 in Burma, some people say they sort of betrayed a kind of Bandung or kind of non-aligned politics, but I would argue they didn't necessarily. I mean, they weren't. They were quite anti-communist, and you had this was also part of non-alignment in a sense. So, the communist insurgency continued to provide a kind of important threat against which the military sort of organized themselves. I mean, definitely the ethnic armed insurgencies did as well. But my understanding is the communist insurgency was really had, you know, a different kind of, and maybe a more central kind of purchase in the kind of political imagination of the military at that time. So, I mean, socialism, the kind of formal socialism of the military at that point was kind of explicitly organized against the threat of communist insurgency. Even before the military took power, I mean, the whole kind of Pidala project, which was the kind of centerpiece of the socialist developmental state under UNU before the military took over, that as well was an attempt to kind of capture the hearts and minds of people in rural areas in order for them, for those people not to be kind of becoming part of the communist insurgency. So, I mean, I think maybe there's a decent amount of continuity, maybe, in terms of kind of formal state rhetoric, whether parliamentary socialist or under the military dictatorship, towards the communist insurgency. But, of course, there were definitely new conditions, new historical conditions in which that kind of rhetoric would take shape from the 60s onwards. Why didn't a pan-Maoist or communist movement develop in all of Southeast Asia? Why did the movement stay regional within respective nations? Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And it's not one I've really thought about before, actually. I mean, a few things that come to mind, a few related things. One is obviously that the U.S. Understood Southeast Asia as sort of the front in the struggle against communism. Obviously, it didn't go so well for the U.S. in Vietnam, fortunately. But the U.S. did set up, for example, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, You could argue that the current Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, has its kind of roots in the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization insofar as the kind of leading members were and are the kind of pro-capitalist bloc. So Thailand, of course, Singapore, these are sort of the regional powers, the Philippines to a certain extent. And while the US failed in Vietnam, they did pretty well for themselves in Thailand. In Thailand, the communist, how to say, the Communist Party in Thailand had a different kind of social structure, a different kind of social background than the communist insurgencies in Burma and Vietnam, for example, which were peasant insurrections with relations to urban intelligentsia for sure, but they were peasant insurrections. Whereas, as far as I understand, it's not really my area, but I believe the Communist Party of Thailand had its roots more in kind of urban intellectuals with kind of roots in overseas Chinese communities. They were not able to develop a kind of mass base. And part of that, I think, is because of the kind of militarization of the highlands in Thailand, where you had kind of U.S. forces working with Thai forces to kind of try to prevent the rise of any sort of spillover from Vietnam / Laos and Cambodia into the highlands along those kinds of border areas. You had things like the Royal Projects, which I believe have their roots as kind of anti-communist projects to, again, provide a kind of economic development in those areas so that people would not end up sort of taking up the communist struggle. I should say that these are like not really my areas of expertise, but this is my kind of understanding at least. So yeah, I mean, whatever was happening in Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam was sort of geographically distinct, let's say, from the communist insurgency in Burma. I'm sure there must be, you know, there are entirely kind of specific histories, well, for each of those places, but also in Malaysia, the Philippines. We all know about 65 in Indonesia, which had been, of course, the most significant communist project in the region. So yeah, I mean, I guess there was a combination of repression of communist movements, of Maoist movements. Really, only Vietnam, in some ways, quote, succeeded in that period. So you know, I mean, I was on a panel in Shanghai not so long ago talking about kind of World 60s stuff, and this sort of supposed kind of intersection of various autonomous radical movements in the 60s in different parts of the world, including Asia. But in Southeast Asia, I don't think that notion of a period of kind of radical uprising, it doesn't really work for the 60s at least. In Southeast Asia. I mean, unless you have like a really kind of long 60s sort of idea of maybe from the national liberation struggles in the 40s and onwards, then maybe. But by the 60s, I mean, it was a period of kind of militaristic repression of any kind of formal or informal kind of leftist movements in the region. I think you could say that was probably the main reason why these movements stayed regional, as you say, within their respective nations.